Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. Today we welcome David Zell. He is the co-founder of the Bitcoin Policy Institute. David, great to see you. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Nick. It's good to talk to you again.
Now, David, let's start right away with the results from last week, US election. I know that your institute had a lot on the line here. Give us your summary. What happened? What's the takeaway? And what are you guys going to start with?
Yeah, it's a great question. Look, it does feel like the timeline for Bitcoin is accelerating faster than even my more bullish scenarios. Pre-election, I think the big focus for us was, I don't want to say hedging, but recognizing that this is a long-term project, Bitcoin. And a president is 4 years. There will be more elections. There will be more presidents. So I think pre-election, our view was this entire industry is basically going all in on Trump. We want to make sure that we are still educating and building partnerships and alliances with, people on the left who care about the Bitcoin issue and who can be persuaded to care about the Bitcoin issue. Now that the election is over, and the results were what they were, everything has sort of changed. So we were really trying to sort of build out two strategic plans for the next 4 years. Half of our efforts were sort of thinking, if Harris gets elected, if regulatory attacks on Bitcoin and the industry continue, like what's our game plan going to be for fending off those attacks? The other strategic plan, is a lot more fun, which is what do we do when we have a mandate and the commander-in-chief and essentially the entire government is positioned to be pro-Bitcoin, which is actually a pretty interesting question because unlike the other cryptocurrencies, which are all just sort of plagued by regulatory issues, they really want somebody to come in and clean up a bunch of these messes, get them out of hot water. Bitcoin's never really wanted for much from a regulatory perspective. It's mostly been about the avoidance of negative legislation like Elizabeth Warren's DAMLA or the infrastructure bill provision in 2021. So it's a real opportunity to sort of think creatively about, okay, well, if you have a government that's signaling that it wants to support this network and endorse this network, you get to be pretty creative. I think where we are now is just trying to figure out how do we make sure that Bitcoin's interests are not drowned out by more centralized cryptocurrencies. It's just kind of basic game theory, right? If you have, even if you're a smaller crypto by market cap, you have a policy team, you have lobbyists that are working directly for your coin. And so one of the big challenges of crypto policy in general has been that Bitcoin is the largest cryptocurrency and sort of the only one that's relevant on the global stage in many ways, but it gets a ridiculously discounted presence at the table because of its true decentralization. So, that's kind of our objective is like one baseline, making sure that Bitcoin is treated properly with the sort of respect that it deserves. And two, thinking about how the US government can back and support Bitcoin.
With today's macro landscape, many people are worried that they are not saving enough for retirement. Now you can grow your retirement savings with a tax-advantaged Bitcoin IRA using Unchained. The Unchained IRA is the only solution that allows you to hold your own private keys in an IRA vehicle. Right now, Unchained is running an amazing deal for you guys where you can get started with their IRA for no setup fees and no fees for the first year. You can roll over traditional IRAs or other 401k accounts into this new Unchained IRA and they can help you set up everything. Go to unchained.com/TBL and experience true ownership over your retirement. Don't risk your Bitcoin security. Do you have Bitcoin private keys stored on paper? Make sure you convert those keys to titanium with Stampseed. Stampseed has this really cool DIY kit that allows you to hammer in your seed phrase into these small titanium plates that are fire resistant and damage resistant. This kit is designed by titanium metal workers that have been working in stamping metal for over 14 years, and your words are deeply stamped, not just a shallow dot. So make sure you check out stampseed.com today and use code TBL for 15% off of your order. Now, David, when we think about the left, and you said you still want to reach out to politicians and make efforts so that we explain Bitcoin as a nonpartisan issue, which we'll get to later today. I know that you want to talk about that. The nature of our country is that we've had Operation Chokepoint 2.0 over the last couple years attack this industry from the left. You mentioned Elizabeth Warren as a publication. We didn't take an explicit pro-Trump stance. Rather, we did take an explicit anti Elizabeth Warren in power stance. And that was something that there was no room for error, and there was no room to mince words on what had occurred and the outright attack. So talk about Operation Chokepoint 2.0. Where does it stand today? What are your thoughts now that we're past the election? And is it something that goes into the rearview mirror or not?
Yeah. So just a quick recap, you know, Operation Chokepoint 2.0 is the name, I think, really popularized by Nick Carter, but kind of the name that this industry gave to what was sort of obvious at the time, but is now sort of, you know, backed with incontrovertible evidence that banking regulators in the United States were being pressured from up high to crack down on crypto companies and Bitcoin companies. You know, a lot of this had to do with the sort of, you know, inherent level of risk with which, you know, a bank was labeled by virtue of having Bitcoin or crypto clients. It's sort of something that happened under the Obama administration as well, not with crypto, but with, you know, other sort of similar industries, maybe like industries that are lawful, but politically charged or sort of deemed as like undesirable by the elites in power, despite being lawful. So we saw this happen with like cannabis. We saw this happen with payday lending. We saw this happen with, yeah, and those were like, oh, guns are like, those are sort of the big three. It was like gun shops, weed growers and distributors, and payday lenders. And so what that sort of amounts to, the setup that you get is really awful, not only for economic growth, but also for just like the political economy that we try to live up to in the United States. None of these actions were done as like acts of law, or done in a way where the public could like weigh in. A lot of this was with both Operation Chokepoint 1.0 and 2.0, sort of mandates that came from behind closed doors, and a process that was like thoroughly and wholly undemocratic. Basically the government relying on pressuring private institutions to go after political enemies, basically, and try to make a statement. I think where we are now, I mean, it seems very, very likely that Trump is going to just clean house at the FDIC. I think we'll continue to learn more about what happened. I think a lot of people in the industry are pushing for, you know, the modern equivalent of like Glasnost, right? Like they want all of the emails leaked. They want a complete review into what happened and who these mandates came from, like how this whole operation kind of played out and happened. My hope is that we get something like that, and that we do shed light for the public, not just for Bitcoin, but for just the future, right? We need to know when the US government is, or agents of it, are effectively wielding making public policy decisions via sort of the private pressuring of private institutions. So what I think, what I sort of anticipate on the horizon is transparency and sort of revelations about what happened and how it happened. And I do not expect it to continue. What I do expect is that it seems reasonable to me to assume that the sort of weaponization of the banking system will continue to be like a useful cudgel for whoever is in power. It wouldn't shock me if in the future people try to do operation choke points against other industries. Maybe it's maybe it'll be Republicans against more Democratic type industries. That seems a little less likely, but it may be the case that we get an administration in 8 years or 4 years or 12 years who feels the need to kind of run this playbook back. So I think the most important thing is, you know, not just ending it, because I think that's kind of a granted when Trump gets in office. I think really unpacking for people what happened and exposing the corruption, exposing the scheme, so that we can like name this and, you know, call it out when it happens again, is maybe the most important development that I see happening.
Okay, so we have a change in power. We have an end to the attack against the industry. That's looking in the rear view. We have now looking forward the potential for a strategic Bitcoin reserve and the potential for other pro-Bitcoin legislation. So David Zell, you get a call from the new chief of staff and she says, it's time to draft our Bitcoin policy officially as an administration. One, two, three, what is on your list? Maybe Free Ross is 1A. Then we get into what comes after. So is it, you know, rank them for me and then tell me what is on your list. Is it the investigation looking back? Is it new laws? One that comes to mind is Right to Mine. Another that comes to mind is the de minimis law for transactions. Is it the strategic Bitcoin reserve? And then you can rank them for us because I know that there's going to be a pecking order.
Yeah. I think one is definitely Ross. That was sort of the main promise. They need to follow through with that on day one. I've got the Ross sticker on my fridge there. That's an issue that matters a lot to me. It's an issue that matters a lot to this entire industry. I think two is obviously the SBR. I think the single most important thing that this administration can do is make a strategic investment in Bitcoin.
Now, David, before you get into it, I want to just say that to you, it's obvious, but to me, it's not necessarily, and to the public, it's not necessarily obvious that that's the first thing. Like, I just want to interject and just say that for me, some sort of protection of Bitcoin, like the Internet Bill of Rights that has been mentioned by Trump over the last couple of days. So I'm not saying that that your order is wrong or anything. So, but explain to people why it is obvious to you that sure. is the first thing.
Yeah, mostly because I think Bitcoin is far more legally protected than a lot of its sort of onlookers or even advocates realize. It's not a security, it's a commodity. Bitcoin, you already have the right to mine. There's no real need to codify that into law. Now, what might be useful to codify into law would be policy that ensures that the government cannot make base energy taxation based on normative judgments of energy consumption, right? I think that's not really a Bill of Rights type thing, nor is it even a Bitcoin specific thing, but that was one of the more plausible, dangerous scenarios that I saw was the proposal for like an excise tax on mining. But I don't think the solution, right? I don't think that exactly. But I don't think the solution to that is to like narrow down on Bitcoin and try to enshrine it with a bunch of like special protections. The cleaner way to go about that is to say, look, energy data centers, people that do compute, will be taxed at the same. Clarifying that the role of government is not to go in and make normative judgments about the ends of those compute cycles and then have tiered or differentiated taxation schemes based on the judgment of usefulness, right? Like the compute cycles that are powering YouTube or pornographic websites or AI or Bitcoin, like, it's not the role of the state to decide which cycles deserve tax breaks and which do not. Similarly, like, I don't think the goal of this industry should be to push for a bunch of favorable special treatment for Bitcoin. I don't think Bitcoin needs it. I don't think we need to interfere with the market process. I don't think we need to be carving out like massive subsidies or things that we've seen other industries do. The main reason that I think that the SBR is the number one priority is because it sort of aligns incentives to the end of all of these other, shielding against all of these other downside risks. Like, the moment that we transfer the 210K Bitcoin that the Marshalls own to the Treasury, the moment that we start accumulating Bitcoin, they become hodlers. And the incentives just sort of align, right? If we're building up a massive position in Bitcoin, it sort of just logically follows that we're not going to undermine that position. So, I mean, the reason SBR is first to me is because it happening sort of by orders of magnitude reduces the likelihood of some of the worst public policy for Bitcoin or like a tax on Bitcoin. So it's not that the interest in buying Bitcoin comes above the interest in protecting Bitcoin. It's that I think Bitcoin is better protected the more of it the US government owns. As far as, right to mine bills, I don't really, from my vantage point, that doesn't strike me as necessary. I think we obviously have a constitutional right and an inherent God-given right to own Bitcoin, to mine Bitcoin. There's really nothing that suggests legally that we wouldn't either. The tax stuff would be a distant third for me, though. I think Ross Ulbricht and SBR are sort of that number one spot. And then I would say like kind of a little bit of a gap, the tax stuff. I don't know what's possible there. I've heard a lot of things being floated. Obviously, I think the Bitcoin community is getting excited about the potential for Trump to just eliminate capital gains taxes on Bitcoin. Maybe that happens. To me, though, like it starts to become more of an example of the stuff that I do think almost sort of goes against the principles of Bitcoin. Like, at the point where capital gains are taxed, sure, there's a compelling argument to be made that it's in our strategic interest not to tax the Bitcoin, but that may open up more attack vectors than people realize. It very much, from a public perception, would be seen as just kind of patronage. It's just, you know, Trump gets a bunch of money from the industry, now they don't have to pay taxes. I think trying to do that alongside the SBR would raise a lot of eyebrows. I think taking ideas like the de minimis exemption, which have honestly had pretty conservative targets, I think bumping those up makes a lot of sense and is a much more strategic place to like start. So I think getting some form of de minimis exemption kind of couched within the same argument as the SBR, which is like, this is an open network that we want to invest in. And we want to invest in it, not just by putting money into it, but like we did with the internet, we want to repeal bad laws, pass good laws, and put some money into it. And so I think unlocking Bitcoin's potential by sort of eliminating some of the awkward tax friction that comes from using it transactionally is much easier to kind of couch within the meta argument that I hope this administration winds up making than a wholesale elimination of capital gains tax. Not that I wouldn't personally enjoy that, but I'm not sure that's the most strategic thing to focus on right now. I think the SBR, pardoning Ross, and a de minimis exemption are a really excellent sort of first three priorities.
And I think it's fascinating that you're grouping the de minimis, and just let's explain that what that means to people. It means if David has a product for sale and I see him on the street and I buy that product for $100 worth of Bitcoin and I send him Bitcoin as the payment for that transaction, in the eyes of the IRS today, that is considered a sale of a capital of an investment, and it is subject to capital gains tax before I send the money to David. And so essentially to spend that Bitcoin, I'm having to spend the amount plus a grossed up tax rate. So that's what it means. We want to get that away so that people can use Bitcoin in normal circumstances. But what David is saying is that, hey, let's do a strategic reserve. Let's get the de minimis exemption into the original bill, whatever comes out, to legislate that Bitcoin is of strategic importance to the nation, and allowing people to transact in small amounts without having capital gains implications is something that could help there. So before I let you respond, David, I want to talk about two things really quickly. Number one, the capital gains tax in general. I agree with you. There shouldn't be any special treatment for Bitcoin capital gains. What might happen is a cut of capital gains tax at the aggregate level, just for everything in the United States, because we know tax cuts are going to go through. So that is there's the potential there. But I want to emphasize what you said in the response to my initial question, which is that Bitcoin doesn't need specific protections because it should fall within the existing protections that we have as citizens of a republic. And so that's a very, very important point. You articulated it very well. And I'm naive then in thinking that we do still need something to protect, but I love your explanation and we'll go with it. So now we have the strategic Bitcoin reserve idea. Now the administration calls you and they say, okay, talk to us about the specifics of the plan. What are the 1, 2, 3 that we need in this plan? We're going to send it. We're going to send the idea to the Speaker of the House. He's going to draft it. And what do we send the Speaker of the House, basically?
Sure. So at a high level, there are two ways that we go about the SBR. One is via administrative action or executive order. The other is through an act of Congress. I don't see these as mutually exclusive. To me, the most strategic path forward is to just do this all on day one. I think all of this can be done via executive order. There's sort of a couple components of this, but essentially we have to, transfer the Bitcoin from the Marshall Service to the Treasury Department. We need the executive to have the authority to set up sort of custody and security solutions. And we need the government to, begin in a Bitcoin sort of accumulation program. All of that, I think, can be done via executive order.
David, so I think, can you explain to people that might not understand? Can you just connect Free Ross with the Marshall Service? People might not understand like what you mean here. And there's a Bitcoin history that just needs to be told. So what is the connection between Free Ross and the fact that the US Marshals have 200,000 Bitcoin?
Sure. Well, I think there's the answer that you're looking for, and then I'll give you a second answer as
well.
Yes,
please.
The first answer is that, there's an argument to be made that some of this Bitcoin belongs to Ross. This was, pretty much the Bitcoin that we seized from shutting down the Silk Road. Although I think, if we're going to sort of take off our normative judgment hats, I'm using that word a lot, and put on our descriptive judgment hats, Ross broke the law. And his assets were subject to forfeiture the same way that other people who gain assets from criminal activity, have their assets taken, right? That's just sort of the law of the land. It is very interesting, though, that the SBR proposal sort of lines up with the ask to get Ross out of prison. To me, the other connection here is that I think we can sort of be of two minds about something, right? We as a people, as a government, like we can believe that it is simultaneously the case that Ross Ulbricht broke the law and sort of did crimes. We can also believe that not only has Ross Ulbricht more than paid the price for the crimes that he committed, but that it would be a slap in the face to Ross Ulbricht to leverage a monetary network whose ascendancy he is in many ways one of the most directly responsible for, and turn around and use it to try to bail us out of our national debt while he rots in prison. Like, that is an affront to like any common understanding of morality. Like, if we buy 5% of the circulating supply of Bitcoin and it actually succeeds in ushering in an era of real economic growth and financial prosperity, you know, if you, the sort of meme of like the small dominoes, you know, cascading into the big ones, I mean, Ross Ulbricht would be one of the first dominoes in that chain. So it would sort of be an affront, I think, to leverage the network that he helped kick off to massive benefit to our country while he rots in prison. That's, I think that, like I said, I don't know how else to say it. I think that's just an affront to any normal moral reasoning you could engage in.
And then now keep going with what the plan is when, so the,
oh, right,
the
right.
Marshall so Service has the Bitcoin.
Yep. So breaking down the SBR, there are sort of two branches of this. One encapsulated in Lummis's proposal, the other sort of articulated and signposted by Donald Trump during his speech at the Bitcoin Nashville conference. The first iteration of the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve involves not only taking the Bitcoin that we already have and kind of just creating a new box around them and calling it a Strategic Bitcoin Reserve and sort of setting some intention of long-term holding, Lummis goes a step further and articulates a plan to purchase about 200,000 Bitcoin per year for 5 years so that America can reach a position of about 1 million Bitcoin. So that's like the one iteration of the SBR. The second iteration of the SBR that sort of Trump gave was more about re-kind of constituting the Bitcoin we already have, labeling it and naming it as a strategic priority to hold that Bitcoin for the long term as sort of like a trust fund for our future generations, for our descendants. My hope is that these kind of merge into one proposal, which is to do both, to create the strategic Bitcoin reserve that we have, but also to begin a phased accumulation strategy. I think Trump can do all of it on day one via executive order.
Why?
The law here is interesting. Really what it comes down to is the Exchange Stabilization Fund. I think this will wind up being the sort of best argument for Trump's kind of constitutional ability to do this. The ESF, or the Exchange Stabilization Fund, is essentially a reserve that's operated by the Treasury Department, which was created in 1934 under the Gold Reserve Act. And the sort of the intention was to provide a reserve for currency stabilization through the purchase and sale of forex and gold, so foreign currencies and gold. But it gives the Secretary of the Treasury pretty broad discretion in managing this funds. Basically, it allows us to, I think the text of the bill is something to the effect of, you know, with the approval of the president, the Secretary of the Treasury may, you know, deal in gold, foreign exchange, and other instruments of credit and securities, in order to, you know, basically help financial stability and like support the price of the dollar. While Bitcoin is neither a security nor gold nor foreign exchange, I mean, if we really want to get into the weeds on the legal aspect here, I think what may end up making the most sense is to actually purchase it via some sort of credit agreement, so that we get paid in Bitcoin. You know, I think credit instrument is pretty broad there. So, I mean, it is an interesting legal question. It's not entirely, I mean, I'm sure there will be challenges. Like, if Trump does this on day one, you can bet the farm that Elizabeth Warren is going to sue, or someone is going to sue. And, you know, it then depends on, you know, what the courts find, right? Like, there could be a TRO, there could be an injunction. The court may say, look, no one's at risk of being harmed by this, so we're going to let it continue, but we are going to you know, make a decision about whether or not this is kosher or not. But from my vantage point, having, you know, I've spent the last few months working on some of this legal research with some really bright people. I'm not a lawyer myself, but many lawyers have been involved. I think there's a strong argument to be made that that yes, this is exactly what the ESF is for, and that the intention was to give the president the ability to make decisive moves to protect the stability of the dollar. So it strikes me as, you know, it's certainly not like a long shot that this is constitutional, which is very different from saying that it will happen unchallenged. It will certainly be challenged. But the real way I would distinguish between the SBR executive order and the law is just that executive orders are very fickle. You know, it's become sort of a tradition, like when you get, you know, your day one of your presidency, especially if there's sort of a party change, is it tends to be a bunch of EOs on day one, first to dismantle all of the executive orders of your predecessor, and then to enact your agenda on day one to the extent that you can. So the way I look at this is just sort of a 1-2 punch. Trump can on day one of office establish the strategic Bitcoin reserve, and then he's got 4 years to codify it into law via an act of Congress, which would have the primary benefit of making it much harder to roll back in the future. So that's sort of what I'm looking at here, is like the first objective is let's do it, and then let's sort of figure out how to codify it into law. Because if we wait and rely on an act of Congress, we're going to get front run like nobody can imagine. And we're never going to be able to stack a million Bitcoin. I think if Trump just comes out of the gate swinging and does this day one, you know, we give ourselves more of a strategic edge.
David, what are you going to be working on between now and the inauguration? And I know that you're not someone that's just articulate on the issue, but that you're actually involved in talking to people that are involved. So what is your plan? What is the Bitcoin Policy Institute's role in all of this?
Yeah, I mean, look, our role and mandate has, you know, been the same thing for the 3 years that we've been operating, which is to produce best-in-class research and analysis on Bitcoin and its intersection with public policy. And what we've been doing from day one is not only producing that research and those insights, but doing our best to take that to the ground, to Washington, and talk to anybody that will give us the time of day. The main thing that has changed is that the people who are giving us the time of day and their responsibilities in the government have maybe mirrored the Bitcoin price chart in a way. Like they're definitely up and to the right. I can tell you what I'm personally up to over the next few weeks. Trying to figure out what I can say here. I have had to become a quick study on administrative law. if that's not obvious from the ESF.
David, this
ramble.
Is a Bitcoin layer, so you can break anything you want for our viewers. Tell us what you're working on, please.
Look, In first of all, like disclaimer, you know, I have no connection or relationship to the Trump campaign, the transition team, or the Trump like White House. I am a private citizen, a guy who runs a Bitcoin think tank. But I'm working on executive orders. BPI is. We are working on drafting different strategies, as well as sort of producing research on why we think this is a good idea. So I would say my time is sort of going to be split between now and January on really those two things. One is making sure that if they want it, the president and his team have well-crafted, well-researched, you know, proposals that they can sign into action on day one. And two, you know, making sure that people kind of understand what's happening here. Because like I do want to give some credit to what I think the consensus sort of mainstream view may be, which is this is spoilage. This is just patronage. This is the crypto industry gave Trump a bunch of money and now he's going to try to repay them by buying Bitcoin. And I mean, I can see why people think that from the outside looking in, but it's so far from the truth. What's actually going on here is that America has just like an amazing opportunity for itself. And so we want to make sure people understand like why we're doing this, why we think it's a good idea. And I mean, a lot of what I've been doing the past few months is just kind of red teaming this and thinking about like, okay, what are all of the arguments that somebody can make against the SBR? Which of those arguments are sophistry and which of those arguments are substantive? And then for those arguments, which are substantive, you know, think very deeply about the critiques and engage with them sort of preemptively. So what I really anticipate is a lot of questions from lawmakers and from the media and from the Elizabeth Warrens of the world. And I think one of the most important things that we can do is not just like drum up momentum for the SBR or even write the executive order or even pass the executive order. I think one of the most important things really that we can do is convince people who may not even own Bitcoin that the US government doing this is in their interest too. I think where this really runs the risk of blowing up is if the perception is that the state is just going to enrich some early Bitcoin adopters. I don't think that's what's, you know, the priority, but that is the, for someone who's not involved in Bitcoin, who the last time they checked was when FTX collapsed, you know, the last time they thought about this, the industry was on its way to zero. It's extreme whiplash to like, you know, turn on the TV or look at the front page of the Wall Street Journal and see Bitcoin at all-time highs and discussion of the US government acquiring a substantial amount of it. So that's like been our project at BPI for years now, is explaining to people why this asset is of strategic importance to America. And we're going to continue doing that. I'm sure you may have seen, we put out what I think is to date the only policy paper on the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve. It's a behemoth of a document. It's like 53 pages. And we're writing more. But yeah, really trying to sort of make the case for this. Because yeah, that's enthusiasm and momentum are no longer in short supply. Like, I think this entire ecosystem is now rallying behind the idea. What I'm trying to avoid is a scenario where nobody can articulate this for reasons that are not entirely self-interested. And I think those reasons are there. I just worry that they're going to be drowned out by reporters and a sort of establishment that has every interest in maligning this proposal and maligning Bitcoin the way that they have really since its inception. So, sorry, long-winded answer to your question, but my time is spent with legal research, working on drafts of things that can be used as models or as templates or just as ideas for people, and continuing to sort of push the argument that it's in America's best interest to just, you know, go all in here.
Well, you heard it here first. Even though he has no direct relationship with the Trump transition team or the administration, he's going ahead with templates for these executive orders that are well-researched and have the potential to be vetted by the legal team in the administration and then maybe get signed. David Zell, thank you for your efforts. We champion them. We want to follow up with you in January when some of this stuff is closer to going down. Co-founder of the Bitcoin Policy Institute, David Zell, please tell people where they can find you.
Yeah, you can find our organization. It's called the Bitcoin Policy Institute online or on Twitter, X, at btcpolicyorg or btcpolicyorg.com. And I'm David Zell. I'm on Twitter as DavidZell_.
Great. David, thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you guys next time.
Awesome. Thanks, Nick.